From Deep Inside the Desktop, I'm Andrew Richards.
And I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Larry Osterman.
A different Larry this week.
Yeah. A different Larry. A strange Larry. Someone with more hair on the bottom and less hair on top.
But we still have a Larry in the episode. That's the important thing.
We're keeping our Larry quota for the week intact.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's right.
So I bumped into Larry in the corridor the other day, and I said, well, you know, we should come on as a guest. And
and I said, hot diggity, yeah.
Yeah, and just had fun with just talking about stuff. So for those who don't know who you are, Larry, introduce yourself.
Larry Osterman. I've been at Microsoft for 29 years now. Oh my goodness, I cannot believe that. 29 years now. I started back in 1984 working on the MS-DOS team on a multitasking version of MS-DOS that no one has ever seen. Wow. Unless you worked with the French Post Office in the mid-1980s. It's a true story.
Wow. Had no idea that existed.
Stayed with DOS for several years, then moved on to the networking team working on the LAN Manager product, which was Microsoft's first commercial networking product. It was a non-OEM product.
My first job was installing LAN Man. I was 15 years old.
Okay.
Making you feel old, so.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Oh, believe me, when the new hires in my group were, I'd been working at Microsoft for 5-10 years when they were born.
Yeah.
It's really sad. Like we had actually an intern where I'd been at Microsoft for 10 years when he was born. And it was like, oh my gosh, I'm old.
Do you think it's different back then versus now? You think coming into IT is different much? I mean, I think you're all more on your own back then. And it was.
I was just going to say, I think it's a lot, it's both easier and harder. It's, there's a lot more formalized structures around guiding you into a career in the industry now than there were then. Mm. Back when I started, this was an industry for the computer nerds, for the guys who, you know, the classic stereotypical pencil neck geeks in high school, the guys who were just, this was their passion because they wanted to fiddle with the bits and put the bits together and make the machines work. Right. And so you sort of found your way in there, but nowadays, it's in many ways a lot easier. It's also harder. There's a lot more people trying to get into the market. There's a lot more people with great ideas, but there's a more formalized path. There's a more a well-trodden path to get into the industry, to get here.
I think that changed from being a hobby that you happen to get paid for to a career that you get paid for. I think
that's certainly is true for me that it changed from being a hobby to a career, and it's been really quite lovely having the ability to actually do the thing that I love to do and have loved to do since I was 15 years old, and I get paid for it. And I'm like, this is like the best thing ever for me. And I think it's true, but you know, I probably am going to be dissing a whole bunch of people at this point, but I almost feel sorry for the people who are doing it because it's a job.
Mm.
Because the reality is, if you're doing it because it's a job, you need to have the joy. You need to have the joy in this career, because otherwise, it's hard to actually make this something you do for your life, something you do for, unless you have that joy in your heart at doing it, at solving it, at, yesterday, I brought up a message dialog box in a new and unusual way, and I was like, woohoo! And I ran up and down the halls, and look at this cool thing I just did. And unless you have that joy, and unless you can find that joy in what you do every day, it's just a 9-to-5 slog, and that's no fun.
I think I love that about Microsoft. The corridors are filled with people with passion and
absolutely,
and that excitement level, and it's just fantastic.
I think for me, that's one of the things that really keeps me at it too. Is, you know, I've been working in support now for 15 years, and people go, "Wow, you've been in tech support? That must be horrible." But, you know, I get to work on really interesting, really hard problems and debugging, and there's just nothing quite like, you know, just hammering away at a problem for like a week and like, I can't figure it out. It doesn't make any sense. And then finally you figure, and you're like, oh, and the light bulb goes off and you're like, oh, I found the bug. And there's, you just feel so great. It's very rewarding.
I don't get that with real customers much, but I do get that with internal customers, people trying to develop applications. I actually had one with, Well, the guys using doing the Windows runtime version of VLC, the media player, they had some gnarly, horrible problems they were trying to solve. And we'd worked it, and we'd worked it, and we'd worked it, and we couldn't come up. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, look! And we figured out what it was. It was me and a couple of guys from the media team working together. But it was like, yeah, we got this for it. And, and these are, you know, the level of problems that you have to solve and deal with, they're hard.
Yeah, I think things are getting harder and harder.
And they are getting harder and harder. It's funny, you know, we've made so much of the process easy.
Yeah.
But so a lot of the getting started stuff, the beginning stuff, the 80% stuff has become really, really, really easy.
Yeah.
But there's still those really hard.
You go over that brink and it's just.
And all of a sudden it's like, oh dear, oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the ones we get on the OEM team. They're the fun ones that you really get to dig into.
I think the great thing about the OEM team is you go from the top of the top in store land all the way down to the firmware, and you can just scratch your head and go. Oh,
one of the guys on our team just last week figured out a bug where it was, an OEM was trying to deploy images on their preload images on their machines, and every once in a while they'd get this like error where it'd say the image was corrupted. And he had to instrument a bunch of code. He wrote a bunch of instrumentation. He was like saving data out, and he finally found out that there was corruption occurring due to the hard drive firmware. I mean, that's not an easy bug to find.
Yeah. We actually had a similar problem in Windows NT 3.1, actually. The server team spent months working on a problem that ended up being exactly that. It was a bug in the firmware on the hard drive controller on some particular brand of Dell computers that we were running tests on.
Yeah.
We actually had one a little bit embarrassing, but we have a standard developer kit. So it's a single machine that's standard for every developer within our part of Windows. So every developer gets the same box. It's a Xeon workstation. Yeah. It's really fancy. It's a really nice machine. The two rounds of computers ago, we got these brand new machines in from a particular OEM. They're all the same kit, and people get their boxes, and well, one of the first things they do is they start playing videos and playing movies and watching things and playing music, and it would stutter. And they couldn't get playback. And so we, on the audio, this is back when I was on the sound team, we were getting hundreds of bugs from our internal testers, because all the developers on the Windows team all have this box, and we all listen to music, or many of us listen to music, and it's stuttering, and we're getting bug after bug after bug, and we're taking perf traces, and we're analyzing them, and we're doing this. It turns out that the into the firmware for the machine has a supervisor override mode that's triggered by the hardware.
SMI
interrupt, the SMI, and the SMI interrupts were coming in, and they would basically shut the CPU off.
Yeah. Yep.
The entire PC went dark for 200 milliseconds.
Yep.
And it was a bug in this particular OEM's firmware that the entire PC would go dark. Now, if you're using this PC, you don't realize that it's gone dark for 200 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, because 100 milliseconds, your mouse flickered a little bit on the screen. You don't really see that kind of thing. But when you're playing multimedia, it's really obvious. And it was really hard to track that one down.
Yeah, I did one of those several years back, and it was the same thing, because when an SMI occurs, the OS is not even aware.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like your machine froze for a few seconds.
It's not yours anymore.
And it's way outside the OS's purview, right?
Yeah.
So it's those are tough, but
But that's that's a lot of the fun, is that those wacky problems that you just get to solve, and it's just cool.
I think the way we finally tracked down the SMI issue I had was we found a way to go in and hack the PCI config space to temporarily disable SMIs, and that solved the problem.
We worked with the OEM in question, and the first couple of rounds it was, oh no, that can't happen. There's no way we're doing that. There's no way we're spending that much time. And we handed them the perf traces, and we showed them the things, and we said, look, you know, here's you know, 100 milliseconds where we're not getting, the OS is not running.
Yeah.
You know, we have this 100 millisecond gap where nothing is happening. And they're looking, and they're like, no.
Yeah.
Maybe there is something there. And eventually they came up with a firmware update that fixed the problem, and, it stopped being an issue. But,
I think you get the same similar issues. Like, I know that there's a bug out there with some OEM where at push button reset. So in Windows 8, one of the great features we added was push button reset.
Yeah, you go to
PC settings, and right down the bottom, you go reset my machine. You can choose to keep your files, which is refresh, or you say reset, which just roughly is like a factory reset on a physical device, right? Mm-hmm. It just brings you back to OS default. When you press that button and no other time, and audio is playing, audio froze or beeped or whatever, right? Oh. Why? And what it was that it was asking the ACPI tables all this information about the hardware so it could make the right decision for the PBR, and that happened to take more than an audio sync refresh.
110 milliseconds.
And same thing as this SMI thing. Basically, yeah. The hardware itself had taken control of the machine
and
during that period.
Actually, on an HD audio, I'm currently in the Windows Runtime team, but before that I was in the audio team. On an HD audio device, which any modern machine will be, any Windows 8 machine will be, there's actually an audio DMA buffer, and the audio engine internally cycles and loops. So if you have a situation where the audio engine can't feed audio samples in for more than probably 10 or 20 milliseconds, what you're going to get is not just a stutter, it's a loop. So you're going to get, the same.
You can anytime if you're playing audio and you break in with the debugger and you freeze, you get this ding, 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 ding.
Yes, it's a 20 millisecond clunk of audio being played, and if it happens to have a transition that's identifiable, you're going to hear it.
So you learned
this a lot when you work on the audio team, because break into the kernel debugger, guess what happens?
Yeah.
So is there anything about audio that people should know about? I mean,
it's iSock.
But is there anything like from a user point of view, just keep your drivers up to date, anything like that? Just any general knowledge that you should?
Actually, yeah, keep your network and video drivers up to date.
Mm. So how's that pertain to audio?
So this is actually more for multimedia playback, especially high-def audio multimedia playback. Blu-ray rendering, 1080 NEP, high-def radios, videos off of YouTube, et cetera. It turns out the biggest problem... So, as I said, audio is isochronous, which means that it's the same time. So asynchronous is at any time. Isochronous means at the same time. And all multimedia playback is isochronous. Isochronous playback is unique because the audio and video samples must be serviced at a particular time frame, because if they're not, it's going to glitch, it's going to have problems. Mm-hmm. The entire multimedia rendering stack runs in muser mode pretty much, mostly. And what that means is that drivers can preempt that user mode code for milliseconds at a time, and there are a number of drivers out there that will just go dark. They're called DPCs, long-running DPCs, deferred procedure calls. These are device-level processing units where the device is supposed to be doing just a little bit of work and then returning back to the system. Mm-hmm. There are devices that sometimes will do that for 10, 20, 40. We've actually seen up to 200 and 300 milliseconds where the entire operating system, nothing gets to run when that's happening. A common place where that occurs is if you're changing monitor resolutions, because the display driver has to reconfigure itself, and a number of display drivers will sometimes do that while they're in a DPC. They'll do a lot of processing in a DPC, and that breaks the system down. So having up-to-date video and audio and networking drivers, those, it turns out, appear to be the two most frequent culprits. Mm-hmm. So getting the most up-to-date network and video drivers, not necessarily your audio drivers, because the audio drivers actually usually often comes from Microsoft. But the third-party drivers, the networking and video drivers, seem to be the ones that have the most challenges. Yeah. And oftentimes what happens is a driver comes out and it's not the most perfect driver. It has some issues like that. We report those to the OEMs. The OEMs fix their drivers because they want a high-quality experience for their customers, just like we do. And then they're not always on Windows Update. They're not always available. But when Windows Update says that there's a driver update, you should probably take it. Yeah. It's often they're optional, but you should probably take it because the odds are pretty good it'll have fixes for things like this kind of problem.
I think people have to remember that in Windows 8, even though it's going to automatically install updates, you still need to go to the optional list.
Exactly. I was going to say, only get important and required.
We'll do a little bit of screen cap. You just have to type top optional, and you'll get it in the Hopefully you're getting a list. Or maybe not.
I didn't think so. I actually didn't realize it was Optane.
Yeah, so check online for updates and off you go. So I know personally that I've seen actually some really bad network ones up in the 5 second range that actually led to a DPC Watchdog timeout, and we've had
episodes
on that.
Oh wow, blue screen.
Yeah, blue screen to the box. And there was a lot actually just below the threshold point. Mm-hmm. And so the Windows Performance Toolkit trace we took showed all these ones just making it before the, and then finally it, two of them hit next to each other and the two combined was enough to.
Oh, ow, right. That's painful.
Yeah, so those DPCs that you're talking about, normally, they should be, under 10 milliseconds.
Under 10 milliseconds is the guidance, I believe.
Yeah.
And then interrupts should be obviously way less than that.
Interrupts are in the hundreds of microseconds range, tens of microseconds range.
They're, yeah.
That's actually been a requirement since Windows NT 3.1, that interrupt processing be as minimal as possible. And actually the model normally is you take your interrupt, because an interrupt's hardware, and it's actually processed specially on the chip. Hmm. You take your interrupt and you queue a DPC immediately, and you do no work in the interrupt handler, and you do all your work in the DPC, because you go in and out, because when you're processing an interrupt, the processor itself
is
interrupted. And so it's interrupted, the scheduler's messed, you really can't do very much at all during an interrupt. So you have to just queue a DPC. At that point, you're now under the control of the operating system, and the operating system can make intelligent decisions about when it schedules your DPC to run and things like that. So.
So still better than an interrupt, but it's still not good.
But it's still not good. Yeah.
I mean, I think the general theory from NT3 one days to now is no different, really.
No, and it really has.
It's fundamentally the same hardware. Interrupts come in, make sure they're short. Turns to DPCs, keep them short as well. Mm-hmm. And then from a user point of view, prioritization, don't go over 16. Because over 16, the real-time range up to 31 isn't under the control of the balance set manager.
However, There's a caveat there, yeah. And this is that if you want to do multimedia playback, there's a new set of APIs that were introduced in Windows Vista called the Multimedia Class Scheduler, MMCSS. The APIs are AVRT Set Priority Class, I believe. On your multimedia rendering thread, you call this API and you say, "Hi, set my class to audio playback or high def video playback," and it's a string that you specify. There's a half dozen strings that are defined for those. You do that, you always want to do that, because what that actually does is that will actually move your thread into that real-time priority class for very short periods of time. And since your multimedia rendering thread is blocked almost all the time anyway, it means that when you need to be scheduled, when you're woken up, you are woken up immediately.
Yep.
And then you go back to sleep to do your work, and that allows you to do glitch-free multimedia playback. For Windows Store apps, and I actually only just learned this last week, actually, as part of this discussion I was having with the VNC guys, the Media Foundations, there's a series of Media Foundation thread pool APIs that also create, they create a thread pool that's much like the Windows thread pool APIs, but these are multimedia threads, and they are also multimedia class scheduler managed threads. So these are actually threads that run at high priority for a very short period of time, and then they run down at very low priority for the rest of the time. But you can use those threads if you're going to be doing a multimedia playback.
Cool.
In a store app. Huh?
In a store app. So there actually is a mechanism that you don't actually have to use a media element in your application. If you actually want to do your own custom rendering, you can use the Media Foundation thread pool APIs to do that.
Very cool.
So while we're talking about store apps, what's your favorite little feature in 8.1 to do with the store interface?
Okay. Well, as I said, we were talking about this earlier. Absolutely, hands down favorite thing. And when this finally hit the main branch and I put it on my machine, I get into an email in the mail app. I clicked on a link from an email that my wife sent me, and side by side view popped up. The mail app shrunk to half screen, and I had my web browser come up on my right hand side, and I was like, holy moly, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
Hands down, my absolute favorite feature, because it is so nice.
And it's not even 25-75, it's
50-50.
No, 50-50. It's the way you want it. Right?
And it's what you want. And I'm like, this is the way it should have been. It's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy that it finally works that way, because I now actually have my email and the web page that it's related to on the screen together. I can see them together, and I can actually interact with them in a reasonable manner.
And I think also the multi-month support that goes with that too.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, so you can now run in Windows 8.1, you can run Windows Store apps on any monitor. Mm-hmm. And move them back and forth, arrange them however you want. And if you have a big monitor with a high enough resolution, you can also have up to 3 or 4 apps on the same screen.
Yeah. I think one of the launching things we'll show a little demo. In a game, this used to, if I clicked on Xbox Games to bring up the Xbox Games program, used to flip somewhere else. And if we do it now, it gives you a flip screen, and then it will let you have any size you want. Now, this is an interesting artifact that you'll see in 8.1. Taptile is the one I have installed here, is an 8.0 app, right, which obviously only knows about the 25-75 split, mm-hmm. so it doesn't know how to render at the different resolutions. So obviously, we will release an 8.1 version that will support it. Yeah. But you'll see this UI artifact for 8.0 apps running on 8.1. That's kind of cool.
It's unfortunate, but I mean, obviously, as you said, the apps will undoubtedly be updated.
Yeah.
And that'll be really nice because it's one of the cool things for apps like Taptiles, like Bejeweled Live, a whole bunch of Mahjong, maybe. A lot of these apps, there's enough screen real estate on the left-hand side there to actually play the game.
If I actually do, so that's big enough to play the game.
Exactly. So I can actually play the game and have two things going on at the same time, and that's just cool.
Skype's a great example of that. You know,
yeah.
You put Skype on the right, just like the Xbox One has.
Yes.
Stock your Skype on the right, have that video call while you're playing a game with someone.
And absolutely.
Definitely.
One thing that we got a few questions about, I know, during the 8.1 beta was the keyboard shortcuts have changed a little bit. In 8, people were using like the Windows key and then page up to page down to move a modern app between monitors. That doesn't quite work anymore because of the fact that we can have them on multiple monitors. So you can use this Windows period, which puts you into a range mode, and then you can move things back and forth. And if you hit the period again, it cycles between the app that you're actually...
Oh!
So...
How very cool. I did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
You can use, so once you did... Then you can do like Windows... the Windows key down to go to
kill it. Is it minimize it or kill it?
It minimizes it. And you can do Windows key up to make that full screen again. So it's kind of interesting. Gives you a little more flexibility, but it is a little bit different if people are used to using the 8.0 shortcuts.
The other one that to know about is when you close an app with your finger.
Yeah.
If I go to before, it would have killed it, went down. Now if I hold it at the bottom, it actually is only suspending it. And see how that flipped? Yeah. That's actually the kill. So you have to, if you actually want to kill an app rather than just suspend it, which is really what happens when you drag the finger down in 8.1, you need to hold it at the bottom for two or three seconds.
Having said that, there is actually a shortcut as part of that, which I learned. Yes. So a lot of times you get an application. Unfortunately, it does happen. It's a shame that it does, but it does happen. Sometimes you get an application that's hung. Mm-hmm. And the guys who actually built the swipe down gesture were actually really quite clever. I'm picking on the store just because it's convenient tile.
And the new store's great too.
If you bring down the store and you close it like that, it's still suspended.
Right. Yep.
If the next thing you do is to launch the exact same app, it kills the old app and brings back a new one.
Oh, so it has to be exactly the next one?
It's the exact, and it has to be the very first thing you do.
Yep.
Right.
So if you kill the store app and then you switch to the Xbox app and then go back to the store app.
It's still running.
Sideways.
Or it's suspended, rather.
Yeah.
Well, it won't show up in the back stack, though, because it's like you've closed it, but it's
That just switched back to the store app because I did something else in between.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually do it. But if you... So this actually is a very common situation, and I have had this happen with several apps where the app just hangs and freezes.
Mm-hmm.
So you go, I'm annoyed. You swipe down, you close it, and then you immediately go back because you're still wanting to do the task that you were doing. So if you go straight back to the app,
still, you don't want it to be still hung.
You don't want to still be hung. You don't want to go back to the app. Yeah. That app's busted. So if you swipe down to close and then you immediately click on the tile, it relaunches the app.
Or
sorry, it closes the app and relaunches it, as opposed to going back to the messed up app that's busted.
That's cool.
And we got a lot of questions about that too, like when I, in 8.1, when I swipe down like that, why is my app still show up in Task Manager? Well, And the reason they did that is because it makes it quicker to go back to it later, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than actually closing it, you've got plenty of RAM. We'll just go suspend it. It'll be paged out if it has to be.
The memory manager will get rid of it.
Memory manager will take care of you. So, but it makes it quicker to go back to that app later if we don't have to start it all up again.
Yeah. Back during 8.1 or 8.0 development, when this whole new application paradigm got brought online, I actually had some discussions with the UI guys about the whole close gesture. Originally, the intention was to not actually even have a mechanism for closing. There's actually no mechanism in a store app to close itself, for instance.
Yeah, I think the preview of 8.0 didn't actually have the ability to close.
It did not even have the ability to close. And we got a lot of customer complaints about, I have apps that misbehave. I want to be able to close apps. So we added the close gesture in 8.0 to meet those requirements. It turns out that a crazy number of people were using the close gesture. Mm-hmm. And then they get a little bit annoyed because they'd close their app and then they go back to start to run their app and they'd have lost their state. The app would now, they'd have to deal with the time to launch the app, and they got annoyed at that. And so we actually started talking to people. We actually went out and we talked to people about, why are you using the close gesture? What's the purpose of that? Why are you doing that? And the answer almost invariably came back was not, my app is malfunctioning.
I want to minimize it.
Not as I want to minimize it, I'm done with it now. I just want it to go away. I don't want to see it. I don't want it to be in alt tab. I don't want to be able to see it in the back stack list. I'm done with it, so I want it to go away.
Right.
And so the new close gesture is actually a compromise, as I understand it at least, is a compromise. By closing, by swiping down, you make it go away,
but
and it's now gone.
Technically, it's still sitting in memory.
What?
But technically now it's
but now
still
it's
sitting
still
in memory.
It's still there.
Yeah.
But, come on.
But you don't see it.
But you don't see it. It's not in the back stack. It's not there anymore. Because you close it, but it's still running. You'll see it in Task Manager. It's still there.
We can do that.
So that when you go back,
well, it's not really running though.
It's
suspended. It's not using
any
CPU.
It's suspended. It doesn't use any CPU. Yeah. It has some memory that it's using, but it's actually not actively using that memory. Yeah. So if the system needs the memory, it pages it back in. Yeah. If the system needs enough memory that it needs to, it'll actually just kill the app and it's gone.
And we've added this,
this column. True. You have to turn it on though, as well as doing then.
We've added that column in Task Manager.
You need to go view status and then it defaults to hide.
Show suspended status.
So you'll see this little column.
And you can kill them here as well if you really want to.
But you'll see that in the alt tab list, it's not there,
right.
Even though the store's still running. Right. And if actually Teptiles have gone too. So weirdly, running. Isn't in the list, but it's kind of weird. But there is now. Because it never got past the splash screen, so it never turned.
Oh, of course, it never turned into a fully running app.
Yeah, running app. So I think all those 8.1 features are fantastic. I think it's going to make usability great. I know on Multi-On, I have four monitors, and I have two in Portrait and two in Landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just some apps that just are fantastic on Portrait, particularly Mail apps and IE.
Uh-huh.
And so I have them docked on the Metro or the store ones on those ones, and then I have more of your desktop-y, the Debugger and Visual Studio and stuff like that on my Landscapes.
Interesting, because I have two Landscapes and a vertical portrait
in the middle.
And what I have is my Mail app, because I actually like the modern Mail app. Outlook is brilliant in Portrait mode,
but
the modern Mail app is phenomenal in Landscape mode. It's not as great actually in Portrait mode. So I have the modern Mail app on my left monitor, Internet Explorer on my right monitor, and the test, and then Outlook and the editor that I use day to day, in the center monitor. And that's how my workflow works.
So you see
works.
More code, yeah.
Yeah, because it allows me to see more code, and I don't use Visual Studio as my editor. So Visual Studio really does like having a lot of horizontal space. It's really nice.
It's docking metaphors more.
Exactly.
Way. Yeah.
But the editor that I happen to use, which is actually, it's an editor that was written by a couple of friends of mine from college. Mm. And I've been using it for literally 28 years now. It's kind of burned into my fingers.
Yeah.
But that one is brilliant. It's an Emacs clone, and it's brilliant for vertical portrait orientation. So,
definitely. Anyway. Well, that's about showtime, really.
Yeah.
Thanks for visiting, Larry.
Thank you.
Come again.
Absolutely, anytime.
If you have any questions, standard stuff, email defragtools@microsoft.com. Put a comment below, and we'll see you next week.
See you.
Cheers.